All right, Simbrush, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back. How have you been?
Really good. I was looking and it's been since 2022 that you were here, which is a little while. So I feel like it's time to do just another introduction for anybody that didn't catch the last episode. Both, you know, what do you do in general and what have you been up to for the last two whole years?
I am a staff photographer and visual columnist for the New York Times. My, I guess, field of specialty, if you will, is style, fashion, street style. I also cover fashion weeks, but really, I'm mostly interested and focused on what people wear outside anywhere in the world.
And since I know that Simbrush is a humble guy, he won't say it, and I have to, that he's just one of the best at this. Like, if you look at any publication and you're seeing some amazing street photos, if it's New York Times or some others that you freelance for, it might be his photo. Because your work is amazing. I love what you do. And I feel like all the times that you've come on, we've talked about almost unrelated subjects to that. We really we met when, you know, I was shooting a Fashion Week show and you were there too. And you've kept doing it the whole time. I don't go to them anymore. But we never really talked about it. We never talked about street photography, street style photography, or the camera choices involved in that. So I thought it would be fun to actually dive into those specific things. And especially because lately a few cameras have come out that are, you know, exactly in the world that you use for your own work and that other street photographers in general might be drawn to. So I want to cover all of that today. It's a lot of ground to cover. But specifically with cameras, well, let's get to the camera second. But I am doing a review of the Fuji X100 6, as well as the Leica Q3, which are going to be comparing the two. And so we'll circle back around to those because you shoot both of those brands. You shoot Leica and Fuji right now, but we'll save that for later. Let's start out more generally, just like talking about going out on the street and shooting photos. I don't know. Like, how is this where you got started, or were you shooting something else before this became your bread and butter? Or, you know, how did you get into street photography?
I basically started probably back in like 2010, 2011 with smartphones, back when they were just not necessarily just introducing camera technology into the phones, but right when I think companies like HTC, Samsung, Apple were starting to become more serious about maybe the possibilities of what photography could be through a phone. I want to say that my first camera phone was probably like a BlackBerry, and then I graduated to an HTC, like HD2. I remember this, like a huge kind of brick phone, probably like what the max size iPhones probably are, about that size. And then with that particular phone, I remember just being really enthralled with the camera, because the BlackBerry camera had no discernible dynamic range. It was almost like taking a photo with a Polaroid, but digitally, just in terms of like, and I mean like a cheap Polaroid, not like a professional level, like peel apart or anything like that. But just like really like crappy images, but it took images and that was cool. But when I got the HD2, I just remember the fact that it rendered colors almost like in a cross-process kind of way. And
it's not just a filter.
Yeah, it's like if you shoot, there's different types of film, different types of stocks of film. You've got like negative film, which a lot of people, most people know, and then you've got positive film. And if you get them developed, they're completely different chemical sort of processes. Not to get into the weeds, but basically, if you shoot like with a positive film and take it to a camera lab that only processes negative film, then that's called cross process. And basically what happens is you get these sort of duotone effects where maybe the whole image is like some like different shades of purple or green or something like that.
A good pop culture reference for it is Three Kings, the film with George Clooney.
And Ice Cube, right?
Yeah. That was kind of when both of them weren't quite serious actors yet. Like they were like, it was this feeling like, oh, can we take them seriously? And after that movie, it's like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I think we can. But yeah, the whole movie's cross-processed and you watch it now and you're like, wow, that is a bold look. But I think that whole era had a lot of like stronger looks in film colors.
I mean, that was before Instagram, obviously, but that was sort of right when I think just using filters on digital photography, like preset filters, were becoming more and more popular. But anyway, so this HD2, it wasn't even the filters. It just had really bad color, but the color looked like cross-process color. And when I started just sort of seeing New York through that particular lens, things started standing out to me that I maybe not wouldn't have paid much attention to before. And I started getting really into like shadow and light, all, you know, your fundamentals about photography. But anyway, went from an HD2 to a Galaxy One. And this is basically where I got really serious about basically every day after my work shift or on my lunch break, I would walk around New York City and just take photos, not of people, but of usually architecture and spaces and things like that. I did that for like 6 or 7 months going into the summer of 2010 and went to the beach with some family and friends and took a series of photos on the beach. And when I saw those photos specifically from that day, it sort of dawned on me that like I might have something here when it comes to like photographing people as opposed to inanimate objects. And then basically over the course of the next year, I got serious about buying a camera. And then as opposed to walking around and shooting just spaces and looking for light, I started looking for people.
Well, and I really clearly remember that era too, where my versions of those photos were puddles and garbage on the ground and just trying to, you know, turn anything into something interesting because you haven't quite figured out how to approach people about photos yet, or that step of having the confidence in your own photography to kind of be noticed on the street is like a big thing. And for me, I was shooting film before the cameras were available because I worked in a photo lab, but I so clearly remember that iPhone only or like no filter era of Instagram where everything was shot mobile. Like it was frowned on to upload DSLR photos. Like that was cheating and no, you wouldn't get any engagement because everything was expected to come straight out of the phone to be posted straight to Instagram. And that even like Instagram was growing a lot because of the filters. Like it had some of the most interesting filters out there. There's basically Instagram and Hipstamatic were the only ones doing a good job of it. And that was like a lot of the initial growth before the social network aspect really kicked in. How did you turn that into a career? Like what was sort of the transition of it being fun to like, oh, maybe I can actually make a living at this?
So there was another thing that was happening right then between that like 2010 to 2013 sort of era of Instagram and Hipstamatic. And that was blogs were like in their golden age. And when I decided that I was going to start photographing people, I was sort of in this life predicament where I didn't really have a lot of money. I didn't really, at that particular point, I had sort of left a career in finance and just wanted to do something else, but I didn't really know what that was going to be. So while I was sort of trying to figure out my life, I was just continually on the internet looking for inspiration. And as a visual person, like the two places that were really hot at the time that I was sort of able to, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to get a little bit more focused about maybe the types of visual things that I was into, besides, let's say, TV and cinema, which were always there, were Pinterest and what was the other one? Tumblr.
Yeah, I was going to ask if it was Tumblr. Yep.
Yeah, so but Tumblr in particular really resonated with me because I discovered something that like I just really had no sort of awareness of before, and that was this whole sort of generation of like young 20-something year olds who were into fashion, and I mean like black kids into fashion, into design, into visual language. And most of the stuff that I was like the most inspired by on Tumblr weren't photographs at all. They were just like patterns and mood boards and sketchbooks and this sort of thing. And so when I got my camera, before I decided that I was going to start shooting portraits, I was really just trying to figure out how can I use this camera to create the sort of visual mosaics that I'm being really inspired by every single day on Tumblr. So I started a Tumblr, and I went around and I shot like fabrics and textures and grass and walls and stuff, stuff that I still photograph that stuff in a way. But then that just sort of naturally progressed for me to people, because I figured while I'm outside walking around, like a camera in of itself is just such a great icebreaker, a great, easy, interesting way to meet people that you otherwise would never meet just by virtue of there's no reason to stop them. You have nothing to talk about. You don't know what you have in common, but just asking someone, hey, like, I love your coat. Can I take your photo? Like, that's cool.
Well, this is something I love about street photography now, which, you know, for me has taken a different shape where we're not doing street style photos for work so much anymore. That hasn't happened for a while, but it's more, it's like travel photography for us, where it's just like, you know, almost more like normal people, where you're like, oh, we're in an interesting place. Let's just capture it in a way that stands out to us. And it becomes a way to sort of structure your day. Like, it's an excuse to go somewhere interesting. It's an excuse to be somewhere beautiful. And it kind of gives you the activity that you're doing. And I think that's actually part of the reason that like mainstream, like normal people that don't consider themselves photographers, but they're going around and you just see them with their cameras out all day long. It's tapping into that same idea. It's like, it gives this purpose to whatever you're doing. It's like, I'm not just doing it to experiencing it. It's like, now it's a project that I'm documenting. And actually it's funny, cause I think for normal people, if you don't plan to do anything with those photos, it can have this, the photography can become the whole point of the day and you're not experiencing it anymore. So sometimes there's almost this delicate balance of like, remember to experience the day too. Don't only worry about the photo project. But anyway, I don't know. I enjoy that aspect of like, you know, giving us a reason to go do something cool.
Yeah, I mean, you left out the best part, right? Like, that's how we met. Like,
right. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, literally, just like out on the icebreaker, just on the street, right? We were on the street, and you and Anya were we were all in London, I guess. Like,
yeah.
You don't live in New York. I don't live in Canada. Neither of us live in London, and yet that's where we met.
Totally, yeah.
With sort of this common interest and desire to capture things just out in
and
the world.
Like, that was the blog era for Anya too, like where the focus was her style blog as well. So obviously the landscape has changed a lot since then. So what does your work look like right now? Like when you're going out and shooting, like what are you looking for? What's the purpose for it and where does it end up?
That's a good question.
Depends on the day.
I want to say that fundamentally, like one of the things that I love best about what I do is like fundamentally my mission, both for myself and professionally, like have not changed since 2012, really. You know, sometimes the clients change, sometimes the assignment changes. But at the end of the day, like I pick up my camera, I go outside and I photograph people, whether that's on the street. I know we're talking about the street right now, but whether it's on the street, if it's on a set, if it's in a runway show, it doesn't matter. Like I just wait until I see something interesting or wait until I'm sort of confronted with like an idiosyncratic bit of greatness, I want to say, or just really exciting personal energy that's like emitting from someone that I haven't experienced before or haven't experienced in a while. And then anytime those things happen, I engage. And I have to tell you, Tyler, like it never gets old. Like I never get bored of it. You know what I mean? Because like the mechanical part of the job, okay, sometimes the mechanical part of the job, especially if I'm doing like a full month run of a fashion week, you know, waking up every single day at the same time, running around and shooting for 12 hours, like that can be pretty exhausting. But what's not exhausting is every time like I just run into a positive person or every time I see someone wearing something cool that gets me excited, or, you know, I land in a venue or I'm in an intersection and I just kind of like look up and appreciate like the architecture around me, or it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be the same thing every day, but it's just like, there's so many things to appreciate about the job.
You know, one thing I love about it, compared to other genres of photography, because you know we've done jobs in pretty much every category, like in studio work, commercial work, or street stuff. And when you're doing that sort of like exploratory photography, where you're maybe moving around a city and you're in a bunch of different locations and you're shooting a bunch of different people throughout the day, when you get home, there's this huge variety of different compositions and lighting and people to go through. And versus like, even think about when you're shooting a wedding, you come back and most of the photos, like there's a different shape throughout the day, 'cause you were, you know, inside a church at the beginning and then you go outside and then you go inside for reception, but it's the same people all day. And like, there's not that much huge variety compared to like when you're out in a totally uncontrolled environment, you don't know what's happening. You're like completely changing everything every few minutes. You get this huge variety of photos later, and you're more likely to find like really weird lighting situations, or just like, I really like my set of photos to come back and be like, oh, like none of these are the same. You know, like if you just zoom out and look at the thumbnails, they're like all totally different. And then narrowing that down to like, well, what was that actually interesting here? A huge part of this whole thing is often interacting with people. It doesn't have to be. Some people just shoot architecture and lighting and shapes. I find often the things that you and I are doing, we do end up interacting with people in the day. Was that ever a barrier for you? Because I know it would be for some people. Like, I know there's a lot of people that would look on YouTube for like how to approach people on the street, like how to, you know, start talking to people to do street photography. What was that initially like for you, and how do you recommend people approach other people?
So there's a lot to unpack in that question. Sure. I'm going to try to do my best. There are some fundamental things that I think people believe about themselves that are both like truths and myths at the same time. A really great example is that I think of my generation, and I want to say of people up to 10, 15 years younger than me, the overwhelming majority of people that I run into would probably describe themselves as introverts. And there's this funny thing about being introverted. I consider myself introverted for sure. We always say like we're introverted as if it's like this special personality quirk that sort of sets us apart from everyone else. But I'm kind of the mind that most people under 45 years old, just by being born into the world that we were born into, with the sort of escalation in technological advances that did not require us to be in physical spaces with each other anymore, and we can just communicate with people all over the world and take photos from our phones, right? This kind of stuff, like,
it's kind of what we're doing
has
right now.
It's made most of us introverted. Right. That's how I feel. So when people sort of express that, like, they might be a little bit shy or afraid to approach strangers on the street because they're introverted, like, one of the first things that I say is like, yeah, the person that you approach is probably going to be introverted too. You know what I mean? And I don't want to step on your territory, because I know like, YouTube is a really big part of what you do, and is a really big thing for a lot of photographers who make a living in some sort of form by sharing information or being into tech or teaching. When we're talking about street photography specifically, I think one of the things that a lot of people on YouTube specifically, when they're doing their lessons, that they don't really account for properly is just the fact that, like, not everybody lives in New York. Not everybody lives in a city where being photographed by a stranger is normal. You know what I mean? And so depending on where you live, depending on the types of photos that you want to take, depending on the types of people that you want to take photos of, like, all of these things can completely change variables in how one would like approach someone, or how one would learn to become proficient at street photography. But in any of the scenarios, I liken it sort of to like a muscle, you know. When I first started photographing people, or when I first started looking for people to photograph on the street here in New York, I had some good days. I had a lot of bad days, man. Like, I had a lot of days where, you know, 5, 6, 10 people in a row would would sort of reject my offer to take their photo. And there would be days where people would be sort of in their feelings about it. You know, I would get like a lot of hostility and rudeness and things like that from people who thought maybe I was being hostile and rude. I don't think I was, but you know, everyone's sort of perception is different. So for me, like one of the things that I had to sort of learn was how to adjust my energy in such a way and adjust my presentation and the way that I approach people in such a way that, first and foremost, didn't like cause alarm. You know, I'm a 6'2" black guy, you know, with a camera walking towards you, like, like that's probably not something that people encounter every day, you know? So once I had to sort of learn, first of all, how to set myself in such a way that didn't raise alarms for other people in their sort of first impression of me, I think from there, it just became a matter of like repetition. Like sports is really big in my life. And I think about like in basketball, like taking a bunch of practice free throws just as a fundamental way of learning how to shoot. You know, I think about approaching people in the same way. You kind of just have to keep doing it a lot, and you have to not be afraid of being rejected by people. You have to not be afraid that maybe every once in a while an encounter is going to go bad. Also, you have to sort of be really mindful of your own profile. You know, not everyone who has a camera who's trying to do what I do looks like me, right? So gender plays a big part of this. Age plays a big part of this. One sort of visual, social, economic, like indicators play a part of this. Neighborhoods, cities, parts of town, all this stuff, you know, requires any photographer to sort of adjust and act accordingly. So
part of the way you're describing it reminds me of how I think about good customer service, actually. Like I haven't worked in the service industry for a while, but I definitely remember what it was like. And I still know what it's like to, you know, receive customer service. You can tell when you've walked into a store or a restaurant where they have like a strict guideline that's like, look, every staff member needs to approach the customer in this way. Like never let a customer walk in here, and this is very North American, like don't let them come in without saying hello and asking if they need something and make sure that, and there's a guideline from the store that's like, treat everybody that way. No matter what, you need to be on top of them. To me, that's never good customer service. Like what's great is when they read you and they're like, it looks like you want to be left alone today, or it looks like you could really use a hand, or, you know, like try to get a, or it looks like you just kind of are in the mall to hang out and maybe you want to chit chat with store employees. Like, but I would, the best versions of feeling like you're taken care of by any customer service agent is that they like, they read you and they're like, yeah, like I kind of know what you're into today and I'm going to approach you at your level, meet you where you are. That's what the best version of it is. And I think that translates to street photography as well, or just interacting with people in general. Like this can also be studio photography. Anytime that you're going to spend some amount of time directing people or earning their trust is a huge part of it. If you just make assumptions about like what you're supposed to do because you saw it in a YouTube or TikTok video, like this is how you approach people on the street, you're probably going to get it wrong at least half the time, if not more. And like you're saying, I mean, yeah, you're doing a lot of this in bigger cities, like metropolitan areas where they're more used to seeing photographers just randomly out on the street. But, you know, I live in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, which is a much more rural environment. There's a lot less of this here. And, you know, if you're going to go out to a small town and look for some great portraits, you're going to approach people so differently. And the way that you earn their trust might be the opposite of when you're in a big city. So yeah, it's just all about that. It's really people skills in a lot of ways. And one thing you're saying about introverts too, it's like, this kind of goes for everything, but like, if you want to get better at it, you got to work that muscle. You've got to do it when it feels hard, when you feel the most nervous about it, you know, just take that chance, be friendly. If you get rejected, don't take it too personally and go try it again. So there's so not a shortcut answer to this, even though it's something that people want quick advice on all the time. And you know, it can always be uncomfortable. You may never get comfortable with it. It can always feel like you're stretching yourself to approach somebody, but it's, you know, it's kind of worth it if you want to get those kinds of shots.
I'm going to throw in like a couple of caveats, and these are not necessarily normal caveats, but just sort of to further illustrate, sort of what I mean. A little over a year ago, I went to do a street, assignment in Senegal, and I spent, you know, probably like a good 6 weeks before I went out there sort of doing some as much research as I could. One of the first things that I'll do when I'm going to a place for the first time is learn whatever the street photography laws are, because they are different in different parts of the world. You can't just assume that you can photograph anything everywhere you go from the street. It's not true.
That alone, that is a very good tip.
but in my research, like one of the big things that I learned was that in Dakar, a lot of Senegalese people just sort of have this mildly adversarial relationship with cameras. Like when I went online to look for street photography or look for street style, like it was maybe a couple of photojournalists at best that had like some series put up. And it's just really hard. I got to Senegal, and the first day that I was there, I went to a nearby hotel to have lunch. And by luck, there were two local photojournalists who were also sort of having lunch, and they saw my Fuji camera, and one of them was shooting with Fuji cameras. So they sort of, that's how the ice was broken. But in that initial conversation, one of the things that I wanted to glean from them was like, exactly how hard is it to just do regular street photography? And they were both like, you can't just expect to do it, because if people start asking questions, like you can run into trouble. Not necessarily like a violent trouble, but like entire communities sort of look out for each other there. And if you're an outsider and they don't know why you're taking photos, people get really anxious. And so I had a local fixer for the 2 weeks that I was there. And for the next 4 or 5 days, the two of us just walked all up and down Dakar. We went to as many neighborhoods as we could. I went to all the major neighborhoods. We would spend 2 to 4 hours in each like place. I would carry my camera. I wouldn't take photos of people, but we just kind of wanted to be visible so that people would at least kind of get a sense of like seeing me around. And then everywhere we went, like my fixer was just having conversations with all kinds of like local people. That sort of set in like a little bit of a level of comfort, so that in that second week when I was like, okay, I'm going to actually start like grinding and shooting and looking for people, it was a lot easier, but that still required a lot of conversations. But there was one day where I was photographing someone whom I'd gotten consent for, and an onlooker sort of came over casually and had some questions. And, you know, 10 minutes later, we're surrounded by like 15 people who are like wanting to know like why we're there and why we're taking photos of people at all. And, you know, I didn't feel unsafe, but it was an uncomfortable situation for sure.
Sure. Yeah. What it makes me think of is that if you take the generic advice of like, you know, just always be brave and always approach people no matter what, sometimes that's not, sometimes, you know, it's like they really may not want to be approached, and you have to like know when to ease off, and read the room. But so aside from, let's say you're not necessarily approaching people, let's say you're more just shooting environments that you're in. What are some sort of like universal things to think about? Like when you're just, especially if you're traveling, you're exploring a city you're not familiar with, how can you do a better versus worse job with it? And I'll start off with like a sort of boring but easy tip that, you know, if you're in a new city, at some point in the trip, it's usually worth it to go somewhere high up with a view. Like, I don't know what it is. Sometimes that's an office tower. Sometimes that's a tourist attraction. Sometimes it's a hill that you have to hike. But find somewhere in each town or city where you can get some lay of the land, some view of where you are, and it's usually worth it. I don't know. So that's a small one.
So first of all, I think it's always worth it. I think whenever I see photos from you or other people whose work that I admire, when they have photos from some of these like rooftops and towers and bridges, like I always get a bit of envious FOMO because I don't do that. And honestly, like your advice is the right advice. I am a trenches kind of photographer. I like being in the middle when sometimes it's not necessarily always advisable or safe to be in the middle. Do you know what I mean?
I'd also just throw out the way to think about it maybe is like in cinematic terms, this would be the setting the scene. This is the establishing shot, right? So even if your whole photo series is mostly details, it's helpful to have one shot where you back out and it's like, here's where we are, right? This is the bigger context. Even if most of the photo series ends up being details, that's how I think about that higher up shot.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And I guess what I'm saying is I 100% agree with you. Just speaking personally for like my work and the way that I work, I'm always looking up with my camera, always looking up. So as opposed to like wanting to look down, if that makes sense. So like one of the hallmarks I think of my environmental photography is that usually in my photo sequences, as opposed to seeing like what a neighborhood looks like from up top, you might just see like a series of rooftops. You might not even get like a full contextual idea of what the entire building looks like. It might just be like the rooftops. And I'm always thinking, this is more of like, I guess how my brain works, but I'm always thinking about sort of the more still and environmental visual aspects of my work in fragments, but like intentional fragments. I want people to sort of get a sense of where we are without necessarily being able to see everything. And the reason why I think I present my work that way is because when I'm in the place, I have to work really hard to try to see everything. I have such a singular sort of almost like tunnel vision sort of focus when I'm walking around. You know, when they say you land in a place and you like take in everything, like you're supposed to take in everything. From a safety standpoint, you absolutely need to take in everything. But in the throes of, let's say, when I'm actually just photographing, I'm really intentional with specific things that I'm looking at. So going back to my Senegal example, right? So the first few days when I'm just walking through neighborhoods and just getting a sense of like roads and entire neighborhoods and things like that, on those days, like I am looking at absolutely everything. I think my eyes are as wide as possible. What tends to happen is when I take those photos, I almost never use them in my work. And I think one of the main reasons why is because some people like yourself, I think, are just better at it. Like when I see you take photos of areas, I always find them to be really compelling. Joe Greer's another one where he has this real good knack of, you know, making sure that he's in the right place. Not like he makes sure that he's like in the right place at the right time. I'm not usually as like, I don't have that sort of forethought all the time when I'm going to go up to the bridge, or like, let's say I go to the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. I'm not necessarily thinking about going at the hour where like the fog is rolling in just at the perfect time. Do you know what I mean? So when I'm there, maybe it's the middle of the day or maybe it's golden hour, but the skies are clear. Maybe some fog, or sorry, not fog, but maybe some smog is like pulled in. When I take that photo, it's just a boring photo to me.
That reminds me of like another easy, very practical tip is like try not to eat breakfast during sunrise and don't eat dinner during sunset. Try to be out at those exact moments, because it's pretty predictable when light is great. It's kind of the same every day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there'll be nothing, right? Like it might be overcast in a way that there's just nothing interesting that night. But if you're there, you can capture it. So, you know, my last few trips, I got really lucky in a few places, and it's always worth it. Try to be around for both of those times, just somewhere interesting, and it's pretty likely to pay off. But before we run out of time, I mean, we're like maybe halfway through the show, but I do want to talk about cameras quite a bit, because it's something we, you know, send each other texts about all the time, and we've been kind of comparing
all
notes
the time
for the last little while, because mm-hmm. you know, the cameras that we've been interested in aren't necessarily what a lot of my other friends shoot. So you know, you were full-time Fuji for a while, like mostly Fuji for almost everything that you did. And I was kind of like dabbling with it at an older X100, and I'd use it for my just for fun travel photos. And then kind of around the same time, I mean, you started using Leicas quite a bit more, which is, you know, very classic street photography camera brand. And then I just was incredibly lucky to get one for my birthday. So I've been using the Q3 a lot and really loving it. So yeah, that along with the new X100, which I think you'd mentioned at this point, you haven't tried it yet, but you know the series enough to talk about it. I think those are two great places to start for people thinking about this type of photography. First of all, why? Like, what, you know, why might we talk about Fujis and Leicas, and how does it compare to walking around with like a more traditional, like mirrorless setup?
I think this is like a really excellent time to, I'm going to say to you, Tyler, that I'm going to try to make this part of our conversation as evergreen as possible. Because I think if we sure. talk about, like, we can talk about the Q3 for sure. We can talk about it. We can talk about the new X100 for sure. But I think there are some fundamental sort of consistencies with both brands of camera that no matter what the model is, like, it's probably going to be true for that camera. So I'm going to try to talk about it in that sense, because
I think that's a great idea, especially because the series is we're talking about, like the Q and the 100, both of these brands approach design in a way that doesn't change much over time. Like, you almost can't tell yes. which model you're looking at. And I mm-hmm. love that. And I know a lot of the tech world wants they want an iPhone to look different every year. They want redesigns constantly. And if it hasn't been redesigned, then like, why are we even interested? It has to look visually different. I just don't feel that way. I mean, like, Rolex does not redesign the Submariner every year. You know, a lot of the best designs just barely evolve very slowly. And I like that approach. And so,
yeah, absolutely.
You're right.
So just to start here. Okay. If you have like a Q2, if you have an X100V, have an X100F, right, and you use it casually, you don't need the new cameras. You really don't.
Sure. Good advice.
The bump in resolution is great, but every time people talk about like 60 megapixel sensors or 40 megapixel sensors, I just like to kindly remind them that I made an entire career shooting on much less megapixels in digital, and also on 35 millimeter film as opposed to medium format film, even though I love medium format film. So with that being said, why did I start using Leica this past fall? Mostly it was job related, but having used the Leicas, so I'll put this out. So I've been using for the past 5 months, I've been using the Q3 and the M11P. And with the M11P, that's one with interchangeable lenses. I have had I've been using two Leica branded lenses and then two Voigtlander branded lenses. So all of that in context. I'm very, very confident in saying straight off the bat that if you are a Fuji person looking to go to a Q3, unless you really have the money to burn and like that 28 millimeter, like you need it, I don't know if I would go. I don't know if I would keep the Q3. I do prefer using the X100 series over the Q3. For the M, it's a different matter because of the fact that I love shooting on film and I especially love doing street photography on film. I think the M11 gives me the most satisfying shooting experience that I can have on digital. It's like shooting film, but not shooting film, obviously. This past February and January, I photographed many runway shows on that M11 manually focusing harder than using the Q. When I use the Q, like, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, you know? But they're very different photographing experiences. So the other thing that I would say, that for a person that's looking to do maybe the Leica M series in digital, that's just going to be a much bigger investment. Like, those cameras are really expensive.
And for anybody that hasn't shopped for this before, I mean, the getting an M lens, if it's Leica branded, will be about the cost of a Q. You know, it's really a significant,
or more.
Yeah, it's really significant difference.
Yeah, for sure. Now, on the flip side, while I love shooting the M, and while the M and the Q have the exact same 60 megapixel sensor, the level of sharpness and resolution is so significantly better on the Q. And I think that has everything to do, I mean, the Sumilux lens has something to do with it, but I think the biggest thing with that is also the autofocus matrix, just the fact that the Q has the ability to lock in and just give you tack sharp focus, which leads to a sharper image. Whereas with the M lenses, you're dealing with human error. There's always an element of human error in there. They don't look like they're using the same sensor at all, just for that reason alone. I mean, the Q is so much sharper. And I know that you and I have talked about this offline. And maybe this is one of the reasons why the new Fuji X100, I'm not necessarily running out to get. I know all of the fanboys online really covet, like, sharpness, like lens sharpness. I'm pretty sure I've said on previous episodes of this podcast that sharpness is not an end-all be-all for me. And as a matter of fact, it's not even like one of the two most important things that I look for. I find the Q to be almost, there are instances where its sharpness is fantastic. What you were talking about earlier, when I'm able to, let's say, take a nice photo of a city, I have like a really awesome photo of Tokyo that I love from a rooftop at night that I shot on the Q. It's a superb image. But that's not really the image that I'm trying to make on a day-to-day basis. And when I'm photographing people, the level of sharpness that that camera provides feels too digital to me.
Well, all of this is why I think it's interesting for you and I to talk about it, because we both come to completely different conclusions for the opposite reasons.
We agree on the specs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Technically we agree, but then the results, we disagree. And so I've done, it's almost ready. I don't know which will be posted first, but I'm doing the Fuji versus Leica video. So you haven't seen that yet, but I come to literally the opposite conclusion, but for those same reasons that I like the clinical. I want it to be crazy sharp. And something that was bothering me about, like, the X100F, which had a different lens, right? Like a softer lens basically. But if there was any backlight hitting it, like if there's any flare, it's a lot of flare. And sometimes it would really wash all the contrast out of the image, which I have a feeling some of the older Fujis might almost become desirable for getting a, like, that really, like, a lot of character in the lens. Like, it's interesting. It's very soft in a way that I don't love. And in the other video, I've got some tests that compare directly the, you know, a direct backlight going into the Fuji versus into the Leica. And the Leica is just, it doesn't, the contrast does not change in the image. Like, it just handles all of that direct light and keeps it crisp. And that's just what I am going for. That's what I like in an image, is like it's mostly technically perfect. And if we're going to break the image a little bit, I'll kind of do that in post. Obviously these are just different, you know, styles of what the final image is. But so I think it's good for people to know that, like, whatever your taste is, you might get closer or further by choosing one or the other.
You just made me think of something really funny. One of my more recent stories that published with the Times, I think all of the photos that were selected, or most of the photos that were selected for this particular layout, were shot on the Q. And one of the reader comments, I kid you not, was like, this looks like AI.
Too sharp.
And that was that. Yeah, but that actually got at, like, a feeling that I had about the camera that I had a hard time trying to communicate with myself. Was like, what is it? Like, I have sharp lenses on like my film cameras, and I love like the especially sharp lenses. I love them, right? But there was something about the Q where the image is just like, it's so perfect that I don't know. I do like a little bit of flaw because it feels real, if that makes sense.
I think there's going to be this is going to play a big part in the film comeback. That, I mean, film's already come back, and I think it's going to gain momentum because of AI. And same with these, you know, more vintage lenses, anything with character that feels less synthetic, I think will be more desirable. Like, I think it's part of the reason Gen Z are using these crappy little point and shoots that have zero dynamic range and were never great cameras, but it looks real. And that's one thing that actually, I like playing with AI. I like trying to see what I can get out of Midjourney, but I cannot make it look like a point and shoot. I can't make it look like a cell phone. I can't make it look casual. It always looks high end produced. And something I did, I tried using it for, to send concepts to a client once for a commercial shoot. I was like, oh, you know, maybe I can generate some ideas, like give them a sense of this is what it'll look like. What bothered me is all of the images, to get them in the real world, I would need a huge, like a 20 by 20 bounce and huge generators and massive lights and like a huge crew to get this look that AI is generating on every single image. There's a catch light in just the right place. It's super soft. It's backlit. It's got it all. And I'm like, well, I can't show the client this because I don't have the budget to produce it at this level. And you just really can't make AI look more the way that like the reality of shooting often is, where like the light's not like perfect. It's not cinema perfect. It's real life perfect, maybe, but you know. So I think there will be some desire to balance that out of like, no, but at a glance, you can tell this is a photo and not generated by a computer.
And I'll say this, because I think the last time that I was on here, one of the things that we got into was this idea. We weren't talking about AI, but we were talking about this idea of like filmic color. Do you remember this? Like, what makes filmic color? And this is another sort of like interesting filmic conversation, that the more that we talk about this, the more that I'm realizing that, like, I think one of the reasons that I do love the images on the M so much is that what makes those images look filmic has nothing to do with the color. It's not the color at all. It's just the fact that I have to manually focus every photo invites that level of human error. Or human imperfection. Let's just call it not error. It's like a human imperfection. There's an imperfection in the way that I have to capture the image that has like that sort of throwback feel for it. And I remember that back in December when I was in Japan, like you and I had a really long series of conversation about these cameras. And like, I was just like, man, I don't think I'm keeping these. Like I don't like them better than my Fuji films at all. And I have done a complete 180 on the M. It took a long time to become proficient enough where I felt comfortable that I could just take that camera out as my only camera for the day and shoot for my job, fast moving environments, like and also like focusing in manual focus. But I really love the returns from it. And like I said, everything is so perfect now, and everything is getting so much closer to AI that just in terms of appreciating art, when something does look like it was created by a human being, like I'm having a bit more appreciation for that than I used to in the past.
You know, also in general, the other conclusion of my video is like, even though I'm saying, you know, I much prefer the Leica, most people should buy the Fuji. Like, of course you shouldn't, you know, spend that much money on it. But I want to cover a bit too, like, why are we even focusing in on these cameras versus, you know, most people, these are not the most popular cameras out there. Way more people have a Sony or a Canon, or an Nikon. I'll give you my reasons, but I'll ask yours too, of like, why not choose what a traditional mirrorless camera is shaped like, or which is referencing DSLRs before that. And those are still what we use for a lot of our like commercial work, right? So if we're in studio or we're on set with the client, like we're going to bring the Canon R5 right now. That's what we'll use. and it just
wait. Before you finish that, to clarify what we're talking about, who are we talking about? Are we talking about working photographers? Are we talking about enthusiasts? Are we talking about everybody across the spectrum? Like, who are we talking about?
I mean, that's a good question. I think everybody. I think we'll end up having to qualify in specific details here because, like, to me, those big cameras, those large full sensor mirrorless cameras with the zoom lens on the front, are becoming. They feel like that is a bit of a burden to me. Like, if I was a hobbyist and I really want all my photos to be amazing, but I'm not doing it for a client, I'm feeling more and more like I would like some of these smaller cameras that still have a large sensor, but they can fit into my life easily. That's what I love about the X100. You know, it fits in jacket pockets. Like, you can really have it with you all the time. And the Leica, the Q3 starts to push that a bit, right? Like, it doesn't fit in many jackets. You still need like a little bit of a fanny pack or something to put it in, but you can wear it around your shoulder like pretty easily all day. And a big part of this difference is that, like, once a lens reaches a certain size, it will pull the weight, the balance of the whole camera forward quite a bit. And that is so much of the comfort thing, you know? It won't fit under your arm. It starts banging against your body a little more aggressively if you're walking all day. I'm not excited to carry that kind of camera with me anymore. It's not that they don't work. It's not that I refuse to bring it with me, but I'm like, I want to have either the Fuji or the Leica. Like, I want it with me all the time. And I don't at all have that feeling with my bigger cameras anymore, where it's like, oh, it's a bit of a burden. You know, I need to have my whole backpack. I need to have somewhere to like strap it on. I usually use that Peak Design shoulder strap. But it just kind of, it feels like work for me now, whereas these other cameras don't.
Before using Fuji in digital, I was using Sony, and I used Sony for like 8 years, and I loved those cameras. I started before the mirrorless, went into the mirrorless, loved my Zeiss Distagon lenses. They were big, they were heavy, but I love them. I love my original G Masters. The entire reason I moved over to Fuji, when really nobody was using Fuji like in the professional space, was because I got hired to film like a little video series in Europe. And I thought that based on the equipment that I needed to do that particular job and take photos, like my Sony setup was too cumbersome. It was too big. So I literally just rented some little Fujis, I think X-T3s, I think, and an X-H2, the original one, because they had smaller lenses that required less fidgeting when I put them on a gimbal. Like, literally, that's all it was, you know? And from that month of work, I was completely sort of transformed, like forever transformed, and just going like smaller and smaller, like whenever I could. That being said, I think you're right about the difference in form factor and size between the Q3 and the X100. I will throw in a couple of caveats. When I have like my X Pro and I have a bit of a longer lens on there, one of the advantages, you can't put that lens under your arm, but you can rest the camera with it on top of your arm, which is really nice sometimes if you get sick and tired of, let's say, having the camera around your neck or shoulder all day, and you just can kind of cradle it just under your arm. So like, that can be cool. That said, I know everybody is rushing out to buy those like X100s because of the people say because of the color science or because it's like the trendiest camera.
Yeah. Most pre-ordered camera of all time. I've heard
of all time. Right.
Yeah.
And God bless everybody that gets one of those cameras. I actually think that if you care about size and you like 28 millimeter, then the Ricoh is like the camera for you.
Sure. Yeah.
And nobody ever thinks about it. Nobody, like, you know, it doesn't have a viewfinder. It doesn't, nobody takes photos on the Ricoh that they don't like. And that, at the end of the day, that's actually kind of what matters. Like, that is a camera that will fit into any pocket, and it takes wonderful photos.
How has every brand not jumped on that? Like, I just think it's so weird that, I mean, Sony had it, right? Which I'll get the name wrong. Is that the RX1 versus the 100 is different?
I think
because it got discontinued. So that's why I don't remember it. But like, you can still get them on eBay for not that bad of a price. But like, why did Sony walk away from that? I mean, obviously, because it wasn't selling that well. I don't think X100s sold all that well until they went viral on TikTok. It's like the world just discovered this form factor recently. But I just wonder how long is it going to take before Sony and Canon and Nikon have their options. I mean, Nikon hinted towards it with the ZF. Is that what it's called? ZF. You know, like, yes. There's like nudges in that direction. But like every brand should have a compact, large sensor, either fixed lens or compact lens option. I mean, it just makes so much sense to me. It's kind of weird how few brands are competing over it.
The problem with the R, I think it must have been like 2013, 2014, 15-ish. I think the problem with that camera is it just came out at the wrong time. It came out when we were getting these, like, not necessarily technological leaps in like SLR technology, but basically the price was starting to come down on some of these, like, you know, if you had like a Mark III or a Mark IV. Sony was just coming out with its interchangeable lens for mirrorless, which was a much, much smaller form factor. Like the A7s were a much smaller form factor than like the A99s, you know? And so it just wasn't sexy to have a camera that wasn't interchangeable. But also, I think the marketplace just at that time viewed those cameras always as point and shoot. And if you remember the original couple of iterations of the X100 for Fujifilm, they didn't sell particularly well for a while because they were high niche cameras. So I think that's all it was with Sony. They just they had a great idea. They put it into the marketplace too early. It didn't sell, and then they abandoned it.
This is a pet peeve of mine when people talk about the X100 or the Q3, or, you know, with Q3, people will be like, it's the most expensive point and shoot camera you can buy. How does it perform? Things like that. I'm like, none of these are point and shoot cameras in any, like, there's, by no definition does that make sense. Because it's a fixed lens does not suddenly mean that every other feature about the camera just suddenly changed into being something that it's not. I mean, to me, a point and shoot camera, it needs to be like compact. It isn't targeted at professionals. It doesn't, it's not very forward about any professional features. Like maybe you can shoot manual, but it's not, that's not the main purpose of it. It's usually probably got a zoom lens, a smaller sensor, things like that. I mean, like what is the right word for it? Because I was trying to say this in my other video, but like what is the category for this? You know, it's like, it is mirrorless, but it's different from an interchangeable lens mirrorless, like just fixed lens mirrorless cameras. Is that what we're going to call them?
I think that is what they are called, but you just made me think. I'm going to ask you a quick question, just a hot take question. Between the Q3 and the new iteration, the X106, throw away the difference in focal length. Let's just pretend like that's not an issue. My question to you is this: which camera lets you do more?
Well, once you take away the focal length, I mean, okay, overall, the Q3 to me, because it kind of just removes every barrier. Like there is some amount of professional work that the X100 wouldn't be ideal for, where character becomes a negative, you know, where it's like, this does need to just be as pristine as possible, as sharp as possible. We need room to crop.
If you're doing commercial work, you mean?
Yeah. This might get used vertically.
Okay.
You know, like we might need to punch on this 100%. That happens. And that's not a huge demand in my life generally, but it's like once you're at the Q3, it is the same as using the pro Sony bodies, right? It's like the sensor is very similar or the same as the A7R 4 or 5. I don't know which one, but you know, it's a pro Sony sensor with a pro lens on there. So you just aren't hitting any of those limitations. And the wider lens, which I know you said doesn't count, but it does mean that with those 60 megapixels, like coming in, like a heavy crop is a little more forgiving because the whole image just is sharper, but you know, sensor, lens, all of it. So I just find it more flexible for those reasons.
Now you're answering that in terms of, commercial photography, but the beginning of our conversation was about street. So I'm going to ask you the same question, but for street. Do you feel that the same is still true for street? Do you feel like you can do more with the Q3 on the street?
Yeah. I mean, okay, maybe not more. Maybe it's, maybe it is pretty similar. Like if it's, I mean, I think if absolute image quality doesn't end up mattering, then they end up being pretty similar. You know, then it's kind of down to a matter of taste.
Do you think it's a $3,500 difference in taste?
No, no, no. Of course. The price difference of Leicas never makes sense, right? You can never justify the cost because a lot of it is a luxury tax. Like the appropriate cost of the Leica for features would be comparable to other mirrorless bodies, right? It'd be the price of a great Sony. So, you know, it kind of should cost maybe $5,000. And you are paying more because Leica is a small company, somewhat hand-making these in smaller editions. They spend more on marketing. They have these physical stores. There's, you know, the logo. Like, there's a markup because Leica is a luxury brand. And you can't justify a bunch of that. You're just like, well, I'm going to pay the tax because not a lot of cameras make... there's not a lot of camera options at this level of physical quality. So you can't justify it, really. That's the answer.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm going to also throw in something else on that too for people who might be listening who are thinking about both cameras and let's say they are into street photography or they do want to have a quote unquote like sort of point and shoot lifestyle. You know, that savings in like over $3,000-$4,000 depending on where in the world you're buying the camera. What you also get with the Fuji, which is kind of a big deal, is the flash, you know?
Yeah. I haven't said that in my other video yet, and maybe I need to add it in because I love that on the Fuji. That is a real advantage.
Not only is it a big deal, like that flash, but just the fill feature of the flash, just like using it in its very basic like TTL capacity. It's not the strongest flash in the world, but if you're like in close quarters, if you're at a party or you're like inside your house or with friends or birthday party or something like that, it's perfect. Like it's literally perfect. And again, that's just something that the Leica doesn't do. And I also found that like when I shoot flash with the Leicas, it's not as intuitive as I want it to be. That was something that bothered me just a little bit. But I also love, you know, obviously you need additional components for this, but I actually think I prefer the optical converters for the Fuji over digitally punching in on the Leica. You can get to 50 millimeter equivalent on the Fuji with, you know, the tele converter. You're not like messing with the pixels by like punching in on that image. So you're starting from a place where maybe it's a little bit less resolution, but it's not less resolution, right? Because you're taking a 40 megapixel image at 50 millimeter with the optical converter. I love the converters a lot.
You talked me into them. So I bought the wide after talking to you and mm-hmm. I like it a lot, but not as much as you do. Cause I find the changing just not, It takes away a lot of that convenience of what the camera kind of is. And one thing I don't like is then the flash doesn't work. So now I'm back to like, I need to bring a flash around with me. But just to touch on that, because you're covering it, I 100% agree. If you're bringing this to like a family event, it's so much easier to have the Fuji because it's smaller and it's got the flash built in. And with the Leica, I mean, now I've started getting a little collection of like compact flashes that like the really interesting one lately is that Ulanzi released one for $30, which is so weirdly cheap. And it totally works quite well. One thing I like about it is USB built in lithium ion batteries too. So you like just, as long as you charged it over USB-C before you went out, it's probably ready to go. I don't find I need my flashes to be that powerful. Like I just want them to kind of work in, you know, that medium range snapshot setting or offer a tiny bit of fill, give like any catch light can make a huge difference between like, especially if people are wearing hats, just that little hint of like, you can see their eyes can go a really long way. But I find that a lot of the time I'm leaving the flash on my Leica, which brings the size up quite a bit, right? All of a sudden now it's a much bigger camera to have the flash there. So there's that bit of a downside. But then the flash that's on it, it is more powerful. It can fill in a full-length shot instead of just three quarters. I don't know. There's some trade-offs there. But again, yeah, I like it more on the Fuji, and I wish it was there.
I don't understand why the Leica doesn't have like a built-in flash. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like,
I have a feeling it's like a heritage thing. They were like, well, we didn't do it before, so we're not going to do it now. I don't know. I also want to just like kind of bring in the another camera I really enjoyed walking around with while traveling and wouldn't buy, but is the GFX, you know, that I kind of reviewed recently. Fuji gets something about physical camera design that like makes you want to carry it around. And that camera's the GFX series is too large for me. I don't want to travel with it, but it just feels really great. It's very satisfying to feel the shutter go, seeing the image afterwards, the fact that they kind of approach color in a different way. It's like you already like the look of the image right away when you're seeing it. Actually, that is a downside of how the Leicas behave. This drives me crazy that like they're happy to let highlights clip in a way that I'm not. Like I would like to save as many highlights as possible. I realize sometimes they clip, that's fine. But Leica is just they like throw it away in the interest of keeping noise out of the shadows in a way that I think is totally pointless. It's a Sony sensor. Even the Sonys, you don't need to underexpose as much as I find the Leica. So I find that I'm usually exposing it down by a full stop. And full I just stop, shouldn't have to
I'm
do
like
that.
I'm like 2/3 of a stop.
Yeah, like why is that on me? I wish the whole like, or that I could preview the images just with the exposure like raised or something. So what I actually do is that in the JPEG preview settings, I raise the exposure of highlights so that my preview is showing like a slightly brighter image. So when I underexpose, it doesn't feel as dark, but that's like it's kind of hacky. It doesn't like, it's a weird workaround. Whereas what the Fuji's can offer, which I think talking to you, you don't use this feature the same way as me, but they have that DR feature. So I set dynamic range, the DR 400, which means you have to shoot at a higher ISO, but it has a built-in ND, so that's fine. But then you're getting the maximum amount of exposure. Highlights are much more protected, and you're previewing the image as you would want to expose it. Fuji hasn't really explained how they're doing this, and I just wish there's more documentation about what the DR feature really is doing. But it effectively does what I wish the Leica would do. It's like you're underexposing, but you get a normal preview of what all of the maximum dynamic range in your image is going to look like.
I thought there was some documentation about the fact that it's compressing in a way where it's I'm going to get this wrong, so don't kill me, but like it's like both boosting the base ISO while also lowering not crushing, but basically lowering in the highlight so that you have like a more compressed range. Like whatever the opposite is of adding contrast, it's like making it less contrasty so that you have more bandwidth between the ranges.
I hope the documentation's out there because I'd like to see it. But the thing is, like, it's not tone mapping it. Like it doesn't give it, because there's another dynamic range feature in Fuji's that look tone mapped, where like it's too HDR, looks weird. The DR 400 feature, if you shoot in RAW and just like, you know, both at the exact same exposure settings, and just like, you know, something is clipped and you drop the exposure of a DR 100 photo versus a DR 400, the raw image is it's all there with the DR 400 setting, and it just all clips in the DR 100. And otherwise the images look the same. Like it doesn't seem to change anything else except, oh, the highlights are there. I'm sure there probably is documentation out there somewhere, but it's just like, I just feel like the Fuji community hasn't really covered this properly. And I've talked to professional photographers shooting the GFX cameras, tossing away that they would want to hold on to that, those highlights, and are throwing it away without realizing it because it's not communicated clearly enough that like, look, the R 400 is totally different from shooting. It's not a subtle difference. It's a large difference. And I think,
no, but I think
more information when making that choice.
Yeah. But I think the reason that professional photographers are doing it like the DR1 way is because when you're doing the DR400, it's not clipping the highlight, obviously, but it is compressing the highlight. So I think.
But what is it doing?
When it's at 100, you.
Yeah.
But you know, like on the settings, when you go into the camera settings and you've got your picture settings there, and it's got like add contrast, like lose contrast, add shadow, lose at like shadow, like those ones. I think it's basically doing a thing where the shadows get like a +2 and then the highlight gets like a -2. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It does. And I just disagree that I don't think it's doing that. But okay. This might be one of those things that doesn't work well over a podcast, because without looking at references, we may not be able to finish the conversation. So maybe, and I'm also claiming ignorance here. I just am saying I'm confused, and I should be able to wrap my head around this, and it's driving me crazy that I haven't yet.
The way I think about it, because there are some instances when I use the DR400 specifically, like maybe not on the X100. I don't have that problem because I've got it has the built-in ND filters, which is really nice. But if I'm using like an X Pro or a different camera, the GFX, specifically when I don't want a camera, like an image, to be contrasty, that's what I'm thinking about. Obviously, the levels have a lot to do with that, but I also feel like it just returns a slightly softer image because of the fact that the highlights and shadows are crushed a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, well, the other thing is, like, obviously, you make it work. So, you know, all of these different settings are, like, to taste. So,
mm-hmm.
play with your settings. Use what works. Do you have any other camera stuff you want to throw out there? Because I want to just, since this is a podcast and we can go long, I want to touch on some life stuff at the end.
About
any
cameras.
Other thoughts about street photography cameras?
Well, I'm going to piggyback something that you said about the Q. The auto exposure functions on the Q like drive me mad. I hate them. I find that, I think we talked about this offline, but I like, one of the things that I find myself doing all the time with the Q is just carrying ND filters. And if I only ever take them off when I'm either indoors or the day is over, because I also feel like, they clip so fast and they clip so easily, and there are instances where I feel like I'm shooting and I know exactly what the exposure is, but for some reason it, like, the images still come out like a little bit brighter than expected, but not in a good way. So on my auto exposure, not the auto exposure, but the exposure compensation setting, I always have it at like -2/3 of a stop just all the time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
For that reason.
I find I just need to keep it down. And same thing. I just got like a fixed ND. And this is part of the things, like, well, now I'm shooting on a really nice camera, so I got to get a good ND, and I didn't want to use a variable. So I got a breakthrough filter. This is what, 3 stops? Yeah. Just 3 stops fixed, and put it on the day, take it off in the evening or once I'm going indoors. But you know, the other downside, this is like getting into the weeds, but now you've got to unscrew a hood first, which takes quite a bit of screwing before you can start screwing on the ND. So, I mean, that's another real win for the X100. It's like built-in NDs on everything. I want every single camera to have a built-in ND. It is always better. Because then you're also not questioning the image quality. Like, oh, is there, you know, even I just took the filter out while we were talking, and I noticed I touched it accidentally while I was pulling it out. I'm like, I don't want to worry about smudges. I don't want to have to think like, oh, did I just soften my image without noticing.
And also the other thing, I have a different question for you, but also the other thing, because you mentioned that, I mean, I think it's a thing that a lot of Leica users in general are really proud of, is because the lenses are so good, you really don't want to be in a situation where you're putting glass on top of it, right? Because the lenses are so good.
Yeah.
And anytime I put like an ND filter, you know, you're sort of mucking around with the image quality. I will put like a UV filter on if I'm in hostile weather, you know, like storms and like really cold weather. But I don't want to. And that's just another thing that, well, like,
if you want to comfort yourself a little, just think of that. Like, every movie you ever watch is shot with like way more expensive lenses through an ND filter. You know, like a Cook lens is 10 grand or more, and there's always an ND filter on it. It's just a $2,000 ND filter. You know, you just have to buy, like, the, if you're using great glass, you have to be putting great glass in front of it. So that, I mean, that's how I'm trying to comfort myself with it. But I think exactly the same way that you do. I try not to put glass in front of glass if I can avoid it.
Oh, for sure. And then my last question that I have, so last time we talked on here, we got into this whole conversation about color, and I'm curious to know, you know, has your relationship with color changed since the last time we spoke? And also,
yes.
What's been sort of your journey with working through your color relationship with your Leica images in particular?
So I think this is actually about to change for me, and I don't want to use it as an excuse to promote the fact that I'll have new presets, but I've been working on some that are structured in a way that has changed my approach, that is really all about hitting a neutral image as goal number one. Like, step one of editing, get it looking correct in a neutral way. Like the image is clean and consistent. I've been stepping away from using the Fuji film simulations when I am shooting Fuji and just going with the Adobe Color interpretation. I know you use Capture One more often. I prefer Capture One's interpretation. I've been leaning more into Lightroom lately because of file management reasons. That's kind of getting into the weeds. But basically, yeah, like, I'm really not trying to lean on any camera manufacturer's color science, because like, I can't get consistency when I'm switching cameras. Sometimes there's like weirdness, like that's what I was finding. I look back, I'd edit a Fuji image and I'm like, okay, it's at a place that I like. I'm really happy with this. And then I'd come back to it later. I'm like, this looks so different from everything else I shoot. Like, I ended up making it look kind of weird because I wanted the film simulation to be easy, but in the end, I'm not happy with the results. So I just like kind of wasted time. And you know, when the Fuji images like can be interpreted to look just like the Leicas. It really all can look virtually identical once you've done some basic exposure, white balance, matching, and you're using the same raw interpretation. So the biggest thing for me now is that I'm separating out completely the color side, like the look, the, you know, film simulation or whatever the right word is for that like the refinement step of color processing, from getting it accurate, getting it neutral, which I try to make sure that's being done first. There isn't something like magical about the presets I'm working on. It just like they're representing my new form of thinking about this. And that's kind of what I've been applying to everything lately. And it's been letting me get more consistency in my work.
So with that sort of philosophy in your post work, if you were to go shoot a job, let's say on your R5 and your Q3 in particular, like side by side, are your applications going to be different between the two raw files the raw and the DNG? That, like, are they different?
The only big difference will be the exposure that I talked about earlier. I don't need to underexpose the R5 really, unless I'm in an extreme situation. Yeah, it's most sensors right now are the same, that underexposing lets you hold onto the highlights more. The noise floor is so clean that you can usually raise it up, but it's much more extreme on the Leica, where I feel like I need to underexpose it, whereas on the Canon, I don't. But other than that, the process is pretty similar. You know, I'm doing white balance, not based on the numbers, because that can change from manufacturer to manufacturer. So I'm usually doing it based on, you know, a white point in the image, or just by eye a lot of the time, and then applying the same final film emulation over top of all of them. So as long as they look the same once I've shot it, then I know that I can comfortably just kind of slap on the same look over top, and they more or less render into something that matches. And this isn't to say that like I've cracked it or I've saw. I mean, it's finding color that you like is a lifetime journey, and the more I know, the more I know that I don't know. So, you know, I absolutely realize my ignorance in this. I've just become more comfortable that splitting out the process is definitely the way that I want to go.
Yeah. I have always sort of worked that way. I think we've talked about it. At least I thought I always used to work that way until I started shooting with the Leicas. And one of the things that really just left me befuddled for like a couple of months, like every like YouTube review that I saw, everyone was like raving about the color. And like I was beside myself. I could not figure out like why the white balance in particular was like just so weird on my cue. And because of the fact that like I kept trying to sort of deal with the cue color in a traditional way. When I say traditional, I mean like 5600K for every DLA. Other manufacturer looks a particular yeah. kind of way, but sure. the Leica Q doesn't look anything like that. You know, so
we dug into this together. Like you were sending them to me and we looked at them together and I 100% saw what you were seeing. I saw that in your images and I just haven't experienced it with mine and I don't know why. I find that the auto white balance makes the wrong decisions. I don't like the decisions it makes. So I'm using the Kelvin setting most of the time, but then mm-hmm. still I found the numbers to sort of line up. You know, if next time we're in person together, it'd be interesting to just take a shot at the same settings and look at it side by side.
For sure. I think that like, specifically in the daylight range, I think that sort of what I've come to conclude is that like the Leica is just supremely neutral and that is actually kind of what you want. And I think maybe what you were saying earlier, you know, some of the other manufacturers, Fuji in particular, like they just put like a little extra sauce on it.
Yeah.
But Leica, I do feel like
sauces, they have, do they call them styles? I don't remember what they call them, but I don't
the styles. Yes.
Yeah. They're not interesting. Mm-hmm. Like they're not good. They look like they're from 2010,
yeah.
You know, as most camera manufacturers are. It's not that Fuji's the only one doing it. Basically every camera has some looks built into it, but they are all terrible. Yes. That's the thing.
Yep. They are all terrible.
Which I don't know why.
No, but I do think, and I'm going to hold on to this. I do think that the range between neutral and cold versus the range between neutral and warm are just a lot more extreme on the Q. Like, between the Q and the M, for me, the like at 5600 or 5000, the color is the same, but at 6500, they don't look anything alike. That could also have a lot to do with just the fact that different lenses have different lens coatings, which is something that I think we don't always take into account when we're trying to figure color out.
Yes,
like true. You were saying, like, you know, just switching a lens on the same camera body could it like impact like color a little bit. But trying to get my Leica colors to a place that fall kind of in line with the rest of my color profile, like, almost broke me. I'm not gonna lie. Like, it took months and months and months to work it out. But
the only thing I noticed being distinct about the Leica colors is it wants to be contrasty. Like, it wants deep black shadows in a sort of strange way, in a way that like I haven't seen other cameras have like gravity towards the shadows like that.
I mean, the Fuji will do that if you do the DR100.
Right. Yeah, actually, yeah, the Leica kind of feels like shooting the Fuji at DR100.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. But it's a lot more precise, and I feel like it's just way more, it has a lot more conviction in that sense with the shadows, which is kind of cool. But all of that, the whole reason why I was asking, the reason why I'm saying this now is because, you know, for people, and I think this is like really important to sort of point out, when for people who are sort of thinking about one camera over the other, or are getting into these superiority wars, like which camera is better between the Q and the X100. Honestly, if you went on my Instagram and just looked at photos from the past 6 months, like, I don't think anybody's going to be able to tell which photos came off of which camera. And that, to me, is sort of at the end of the day why I agree 100% with you when you say that the Fuji is for most people. Strictly because of the price, but also because, like you said, unless you're like in a commercial environment where you just need that high specificity of like clinical execution,
gotta match a Pantone color.
Yeah, whether it's a Fuji, whether it's a Ricoh, whether you get a Sony RX over the internet, like, they're all going to give you a version of something that ranges from really good to great. And I don't think the price point really makes a difference between any of these, and people looking at your photos aren't really going to care how sharp they are. So
for all the conversations about like this brand has great colors, this is actually what I posted on Threads like right before we started recording. Everybody's like, oh, this brand of camera has great colors. Obviously, I mean, I've gone on enough about like color science is a bit of a myth, but
for sure.
The thing is, when you look at the photographers you love, what you're seeing isn't the result of their camera colors at all, almost ever. Like, yes. I know there are some, there are a few pros out there that basically publish as they shoot, but it's not common. You're usually seeing their taste in post-processing. They're choosing a film style from Capture One. They're using a Lightroom preset, or they're just using what came out of camera and making some significant tweaks. Nobody is post, not nobody, not many professionals post the colors that are coming straight out of their camera. It's so rare. Yes. Like, there's no point in judging color between camera brands.
And it is also kind of a myth that some cameras are easier to work colors than others. I'm of the mind now that different manufacturers sort of make you think about colors in maybe slightly different ways, but also going back to that whole thing about being introverted, right? Like, we all sort of have different creative minds, and not everybody thinks about color in the same way. And
not even close.
The fact that we don't make account for that is also a thing that's just like, you know, if somebody has never messed around with digital color before, or really been serious about photography, you hand them any camera in the world and just give it to them for 6 months, and they're gonna get to a place that works for them, if nothing else, no matter what they're using. And I think we don't make room enough for that in the conversations that we're having, especially when we make these broad proclamations on what's best and what people should buy.
I think we just need to get to that place now with video color, which is a much messier universe, harder to manage. Before we run totally over time, I just want to like hit on just like life stuff, because I haven't podcasted as much lately. And this is totally like a selfish topic, but it's because it's what's been at the top of my mind for the last like 4 months or so. So this is going to be boring to half the audience. If you don't care, this is the time you can tune out. But, I kind of hit the point where I'm like, I 100% need to take fitness and my life seriously. And, you know, before 4 months ago, this is the part where I would tune out of a podcast too. But now that I've finally gotten over that hurdle where it feels like, where now I feel like I need to do it. Like, the day feels so much better after I've gone to the gym, getting, you know, some amount of steps in the day, like, makes me way less tired. I stopped having those afternoon like burnouts of like, you know, an hour or two, 3 hours after lunch, I just need a nap. That actually has mostly gone away, which that's maybe like the biggest like excitement for me overall with it. Cause like, I've just always been tired. Like, my whole life I've been tired, and I don't know, I'm just kind of doing the basic things, going to the gym a few times a week, and I don't feel exhausted in the afternoon. And that's like a little bit life-changing. So I don't know, I just wanted to like bring it up. I know last time we saw each other in person, which is a couple of years ago now, but you at least were like keeping track of your steps, running a bit. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't have a question. I just wanted to bring it up.
No, I mean, I'm still doing that. And I mean, listen, this is like really, it's really important. I you know, we've all heard some sort of really sage like economic advice when it comes to like saving, and I'm pretty sure everybody's had like seen some model where like, you know, if you start saving like this amount of money when you're 18, like versus when you're 45 and you start saving like to get to this amount of money when you're 65 is like significantly different, right? Like, fitness is kind of the same, you know.
100%. Yeah.
For me personally, like, the biggest thing for me about fitness isn't about strength. It's not about endurance. It's about mental wellness. I'm not going to lie. Like,
right.
I don't like to run. I don't. But I do it. I do it because, like, it's so necessary for me to create space to be able to work and create space for me to be able to appreciate the things that I have going on in my life, which are really hard to sometimes identify and pinpoint when my head is just down and I'm just working all the time. Mm-hmm. But also in the periods where like I'm keeping up with my fitness, like, you know, it also drives a lot of my nutrition decisions. And like one of the simplest but biggest like nutritional decisions that I ever made, that I've made like in the past, I think 10 years, that has just had like a significant impact on my wellness of life now, is just like, stop drinking soda.
You know? Yeah.
I might have a soda like once a month, you know, maybe twice. If it's like a fashion week, especially, like that's just a different sort of a physical toll environment where, you know, 14-hour days just running 20,000 steps a day. Like, I don't feel necessarily so bad about maybe having a soda for the sugar intake, yeah, but
the sugar's when gone I'm home, within like an hour.
Yeah. Like these periods now, like where I'm home here in New York, like if I'm going to drink something and it's not coffee, like in the morning, it's probably just going to be water. I find that when I have like a junk food meal, honestly, like if I have like a hamburger and fries with water, I deal so much better in the ensuing hours than if I have like that sugary drink next to it.
Yeah.
So I just kind of want to like pin those things together, because I think they work together.
Completely,
and for people who don't like to run, or people who don't think they're good at running, like just get out and do it.
Or do a different, I was one of those people. Or do a different thing, like being really specific. I find a lot of the advice is like, you need to do this thing that worked for me, but there's a lot of things that work for a lot of people.
Yes. But I will say, if you can run, and by can, I mean like you can walk without like a physical assistance of like a cane or a walker or something like that. I'm saying this about myself. So for anybody else that has dealt with this or dealing with this, like I grew up played sports. When I started doing photography and walking around street photography, I stopped because I didn't want to injure myself and not be able to walk and take photos. But then for the ensuing years, like I gained a lot of weight and my fitness was really bad, even though I was going to the gym. And when I decided that I was going to start running again, I was having all sorts of like physical, like little micro injuries, like with my knee, with my ankle, with stuff like that. And obviously it's a good idea to like get your physical and see a doctor and stuff before you start like heavy exercise and stuff like that. But really the reason that I was having all of these issues was because my legs were just weak.
Yeah, right.
So when I have friends where they're like, I want to run, but like I can't because like I have like a bad foot or I have a bad, it's like, it's going to stay like that, you know, unless you figure out a way to like at least strengthen them so you can be more mobile. But just being mobile, no matter what you're doing, is such a boost on a person's like mental well-being.
For sure. And I mean, my version of that, so running is the cardio thing that I like enjoy the most. Since I've been doing this, it's kind of been winter the whole time, so I haven't been able to run outside much. But one thing I realized with it is that like the point that I used to feel like I was like, I'm done, I'm getting a cramp, I want to stop now, which would maybe be like 15 to 20 minutes in, I've started to realize that's usually, it's like not long after that I actually start feeling really good. And I didn't push past it before. I would always like, okay, like I got to, like, this is really, I'm getting the stitch. Like I'm uncomfortable now, like good enough, 20 minutes. And I've started realizing it's like, oh, like maybe like 25, 26 minutes in, like that's when that bit of like adrenaline starts kicking in, or like the endorphins or whatever makes you feel good when you're running. And I've just suddenly understood it in a way that it took a long time for me to figure this out. And then same that you were saying about the pains in your feet, legs, whatever it is that might keep you from running. So I was feeling like I just like kind of pulled my back doing something very simple and stupid the other, like a few months ago, that really kind of triggered me doing all this. And so much of it, so a lot of what I'm doing is more like weight training, but it's that feeling of like, look, my back is only going to hurt more if it is weak. Like if I don't have strength to lift heavy things, someday I'll injure myself lifting a heavy thing. So I better do it purposefully before that becomes an issue.
No, I was just going to say that, like, that little last thing that you said, the thing that I think trips up a lot of people is when you become weaker in those areas, the threshold at which you think something is too heavy might be very different than your back.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
You don't necessarily know where the weak point is until, and I want to double down on the point that you were saying about nutrition being connected to the exercise, which I've known this for a while because, you know, I've gone through phases of trying to work out more. It's just the first time that's stuck for a long time. And as soon as I'm doing something intentional to exercise, that's when it feels like the rest of my diet actually matters and I can follow through with what I already know I should be doing. But all of a sudden, having a soda in the afternoon, I'm like, well, like, why am I going to, you know, I put all this work in this morning. Why am I going to like dump 150 calories of just sugar in for no good reason? I'll skip it. It's so much easier to make those right decisions later, knowing that they have an impact on what I was doing in the morning. Or in my case, you know, I've always been skinny and up until recently, which then I became skinny fat. And so for me, part of it's like also, you know, I feel like I need a little more muscle on my body for long-term health reasons too. Just for, I saw the like videos of MRIs of 80 or 90 year olds living a sedentary life versus a, you know, a active life, and your muscle deterioration when you're older is so significant, and it's going to happen no matter what, whatever you're doing. So a lot of my thinking now is, you know, I need to have enough muscle now that I have room to deteriorate later. But so for me, that also means like increasing my protein intake, you know, in an intentional way. And that is so much more doable when I'm like, well, I know I did the exercise earlier. So why would I not follow through? If I don't follow through, then it's going to be somewhat wasted. And everything just keeps itself in check in like such a helpful way that I don't know. I feel like a lot of the things that I have to say about this are almost like, if you go to fitness YouTube or whatever, if you like watch workout influencers, this is the 101, like they don't focus on this very much. But I also find that they assume that you love exercise, like because they do. Yeah. Or even when you talk to personal trainers, it's like, well, they love working out, so they're going to talk in a way that would assume you do too. And I hate it, you know, like it
was, or that you will once you start. You know?
Yeah. And it's like, it's a big,
like,
barrier.
I still hate running, but I do it, you know,
sure,
like
yeah.
it's, but I mean, I'm, that's not true. I don't hate running. Like yeah. when I am running, I am always happy to be running.
Right.
You know, my brain has never gotten around to the, yeah, my brain's never came around to the point where it's just like, I want to run.
Right.
It's more like, we should run. You know what I mean?
Well, we'll see. I'll eventually be able to, you know, assuming I'm in better shape in a few months than I was at the beginning, then I'll follow up with this, 'cause I want to talk about the tech side of it as well. Like how I've been using my Apple Watch and the different apps that have really helped out with kind of keeping track of it. But, it's probably all for a later date, 'cause this has been a long episode, but
you're on the last one. You're on the latest iteration of the Apple Watch. Which one do you have?
No, I have the first Ultra. So, that's what I'm using most of the time, just like the regular Ultra. But I don't, for everything I'm recommending, there's no significant difference. You could use an Apple Watch SE. Like it's actually still the most basic features of it that I find the most helpful. I mean, just to say the most significant way that it's helped me is just actually really looking at my steps every day. Like I would challenge myself occasionally when I was traveling. I'm like, let's see if I can get to 20K. But just being like, no, I'm going to do 10,000 a day was the biggest change in me actually hitting that goal. Was like just looking at it. I put it on my home screen. I keep an eye on it. And even on a non-busy day when I'm not traveling, I'm now able to get 11 or 12,000 steps in, which is like, I mean, it's double. It's completely different from what I was getting last year. So
I have a Garmin. It's not sexy. It's not as expensive as an Apple Watch either, but it lasts for a week without having to recharge it. And for me, that was the only reason why I picked that over an Apple Watch.
Well, and also people that don't want to wear a watch, I mean, just keep your phone in your front pocket when you're walking around, and it'll, the thing is, like, you don't need perfect accuracy. You just need consistent inaccuracy, you know, like if it's the same amount of inaccurate every day, it doesn't really matter. You just know the scale of like, did I do more or less than previously? And try to keep that up, you know, it'll give you a pretty good sense of what you're doing. So,
right.
Well, For anybody watching the video, this
I'm starting it like a
I love the
crazy
flare
glare,
that you've got
right?
going. You're clearly shooting this on the next one.
There we are.
Yeah, looks great.
How's that?
But Simbrush, thanks again for coming and sharing your wisdom. Again, if anybody hasn't seen Simbrush's work, you got to go see it. Go follow him on Instagram. There'll be links in the show notes. Thanks for being here, man.
Thanks for having me, always.